This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Aaron Weinacht here with the New Books Network. This is the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of that project. And today we're talking to Tim Hart, who is a professor of Russian out at Bryn Mawr, right?
That is correct.
And who is currently serving as provost there. So thanks for being a guest today, Tim.
My pleasure.
So first off, could you tell everybody, how'd you get into Russian history, kind of the background on how you ended up arriving at writing a book about the images of sport in Russian and Soviet art?
Okay, happy to explain how I got to this place into this book. I grew up outside of Boston in my public high school right outside of Boston, Concord Carlisle High School. It was the tail end of the Cold War when I was in high school, and we had a Russian program. So the teacher was actually not the most responsible of teachers, but he got us really interested in Russian language. And so having taken, I think, 3 years of Russian in high school, I went on in college to it, undergrad at Harvard, and at Harvard ended up majoring in Slavic, I think it was Soviet and East European Studies, was what it was called at the time. And I took the language. I don't know if I was the most serious student, but my senior year in college, wrote a thesis on the literature of Mikhail Bulgakov and the fantastic in Bulgakov, and really enjoyed that process of writing a senior thesis. Lucked out with my thesis advisor, William Mills Todd III, who's an emeritus now at Harvard, and really sort of lucked out with our connections there. So I felt that was almost dumb luck on my part. And just really, it was the first time in college that I really enjoyed my studies wholeheartedly and loved doing that. So sort of out of that, went to Russia, came back, went to Madison, Wisconsin for my master's, was thinking about a PhD program there. While I was at Madison, took a graduate seminar from Claire Kavanaugh on the poetry of Osip Mandelstam, where there were these four little poems that I noticed that he had about sports, and that piqued my curiosity. I wrote an article about it, and that was the beginning of my interest in the sports theme of my book. But then I transferred back to Harvard, and then really worked with did most of my work, not with William Mills Todd, who was a second reader on my dissertation, but really John Malmsted, who was a Russian avant-garde expert and a cultural historian of sorts. So out of that sort of focus on cultural history, really sort of that piqued my curiosity. And John Malmsteed had a small little article as well about wrestling in Russian avant-garde art that also caught my attention. So was interested in that. I also should note that I grew up an avid athlete. I've always been a long distance runner. So I have that in my background and somewhat of a sports fan. So had that interest. And I competed intercollegiately in college as well as a runner. So had that and then wrote my dissertation, not really on sports. I had thought about writing my dissertation on sports, but wanted to be a little broader and focused on the theme of speed and dynamism in Russian avant-garde art. And sports certainly happens to be a component of that dynamism that that emerged at the beginning of the 20th century in Russian avant-garde art. So wrote my dissertation. Out of my dissertation came my first book, Fast Forward, and the Aesthetics and Ideology of Speed in Russian Avant-Garde Art. And then as a second book and something more, I would say this closer to my heart, was the sports theme. And really sort of after the publication of my first book, that's what I set down to do, is to really work on cultural history of sports in Russia and that intersection of sports, Russian and Soviet, early Soviet history and art, be it cinema, be it poetry, be it painting, be it photography. So really loved that. All being able to work in a number of mediums was also appealing to me as someone who gradually through graduate school became more and more engrossed by cinema. So, and this has allowed me to indulge all my interests in one fell swoop. Yeah.
It's nice to be able to write your own ticket that way.
It was up to me and it was an underappreciated theme, I would say. There have been histories of athletics and history of sports in the Soviet Union, but not a really comprehensive look at the way that it intersected with the arts and the way that so many artists embraced it. Part of the issue being that some folks in the academy have thumbed their nose at sports or seen it as a not so serious topic. I'm just going to exit this. And so that, I think, allowed a space for my book where I think there weren't as many, maybe a sort of a, not a snobbish disregard for sports, but somehow seen it as a crass pastime and the other thing I noted that many scholars weren't taking sports as sport and as play, but as seeing it as a metaphor for something else, and that if an artist was incorporating some aspect of sports into their work, that is often the immediate reaction was to see it as a metaphor for something. And instead of really thinking about the way that sports was this cultural phenomenon at the turn into the 20th century and really grabbed Western society in a profound way and in many ways accompanied or complemented a lot of the changes in society at that time. And it's only natural that a lot of artists would be interested in that new phenomenon of sports. And that's always what has interested me about it.
So since you brought up the kind of broader Western context, I was thinking it might be good here at the beginning if you could kind of backdrop the overall context in which Russian sports develops there in the late, 19th, early 20th century. I think that'd be useful to do.
Sure. Certainly, a lot of the Western sports movement arose not in Russia, but in England with soccer. Even before that, more sort of upper crust sports that gave way to more common sports such as soccer or football and rugby a bit to the, and but there was a sense in coming out in the 19th century that's all of a sudden it was not just an aristocratic pastime and aristocratic play, but something that would be accessible to everyone in society. In part, there were ways that it was used by the wealthy to entertain or distract the workers, and to keep them happy is to have them engage in sports. So that was certainly part of it. But in the middle of the 19th century, sports starts to spread. I mean, you can see this in the literature as well. But I think out of England comes an excitement for competitive sports that harken back certainly to the ancient Greek times when the ancient Olympics occurred. But it was a revival of that. You move into the later part of the 19th century when sports are beginning to become more and more popular, and then there is the revival of the Olympic Games. So that's a crucial point is 1896, and the first modern Olympic Games, which a few nations take part in. At the same time, you also have in America, the U.S., you have a lot of interest in sports as well, with baseball and football taking hold at that time. So a lot of these new sports are arising as popular pastimes. And then coming into the new century, you have, as I said, you have the Olympic Games, and then Russia wanting to be involved in that international movement that was meant in many ways to seen as a way of improving the nations and a way for nations to show their mettle, show their worth, show what great nations they are. And Russia certainly, and the czars wanted to take part in that phenomenon, gradually did, even though there was some resistance in Russia, where Russian sports emerges, though, is, and that's what one of the chapters in my book is on, is circus wrestling. And that's for me was a fun aspect to research, was all this phenomenon of circus wrestling that so many artists noted at the end of the 19th century into really the first decade of the 20th century, that it was just hugely popular. Circus wrestling, Bartsy, in particularly in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but it would had a sort of rural veneer where these strongmen would come from the countryside and wrestle in the circuses, and then that metastasized, I guess you could say, to international wrestling tournaments that occurred at the circuses, the Chinozeli Circus in Petersburg, a bunch of circuses in Moscow, and gradually it took hold as this popular sport. That dies down by the start of World War One, there's really less of an interest, popular interest in wrestling, but other sports sort of take over, with soccer being a more proletarian sport, and even some tennis, but just a gradual into the Soviet era, just a continuation of the way that it was seen as a reflection of the strength. Sports was a way for countries to demonstrate their health, I guess you could say, and this emphasis on health. So that would be maybe some of the historical background.
Right. I was thinking you started to get onto this here just a second ago, that so you got this you know, hugely productive artistic period, you know, say, you know, kind of 1890s through the, you know, really through the, until Stalin.
Late 20s.
Yeah, late 20s, let's say. Like, kind of at that, and then lots of those artists are very much, I mean, they're political thinkers, and I mean, they're involved in the revolutionary movement in lots of ways. So, like, what aesthetic significance are they investing sports with in that context? Like, what, you know, what kinds of themes that come out in sports, or what kind of, you know, artistic, you know, aesthetic are they seeing there as a real possibility?
That's a good, interesting question.
I'm not sure I asked it very well, but
maybe referencing my first book, certainly the dynamism of it, and that there was a sheer beauty that was perceived in sports that to this day is perceived, that the emphasis on the body, certainly, and that the body could do beautiful, beautiful things in the sports arena, that there was this going beyond the everyday to show audiences, and these were popular events. So if an artist is seeking popularity, it is an interesting way to attract audiences. But I think just to convey some of that beauty that is maybe more familiar to us today and more common, but was more of a new phenomenon at the beginning of the 20th century. And certainly you have with wrestling the sheer size of these hulking strongmen, I think caught the attention of artists, but certainly athletes moving fast, athletes throwing things, jumping, that itself had an intrinsic beauty to it. In my book, I also talk about the Greek concepts of aret and agon, and that sense of excellence and then competition that maybe is not those aren't aesthetic, but that artists certainly saw the model of athletes striving for excellence as maybe a model for their own work, as they sort of strove for excellence, and that as seeing athletes almost as models for what they're doing.
No, I got when I got home after I finished your book, I was telling my wife about it, and we got in a big argument about whether or not sports can be art.
And yeah. Oh, yeah.
You addressed that question a little bit. As I recall, you assiduously avoided taking a position on it, which is probably wise. But I don't know. So I was thinking about that difference in those two Greek terms you mentioned. Is that, you know, it seems like once you get into the competition, side of the equation. Maybe it's a little harder to argue that sports are art, but purely, I don't know, say like a strong man who's really not competing against anybody but himself in the same way that, like, if you're a musician, you're just trying to play better, right? That seems to me to certainly qualify as art. Is that, I don't know, would you agree with that, or?
That it would, that a strong man would qualify as art. And I address this in my book, but the conscious, you know, an artist is trying to consciously produce art, right? A strong man wrestling in a wrestling ring, or a tennis player, it's debatable whether that is a conscious act of creativity.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, and it's this issue of that, because of the agon, because of the competition, you want to win, right? Yeah. And that's the goal. It's not to impress people with the artistry per se, but then, you know, on the flip side, you know, when I quote a bunch of these folks, you know, sort of David Foster Wallace, you know, talking about Roger Federer playing tennis and how just he's an artist out there, and there's a beauty to it. And, you know, in certain ways, Roger Federer, when he was playing, was trying to hit a backhand in a way that, again, is it so that he could win? Probably. Yeah. But there's also a smooth elegance to it that at least hovers around art. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, it's one of those questions that, I mean, it doesn't really have an answer, you know, in the long run, right? But it just seemed to me like your book kind of unexpectedly, at least to my mind, it's unexpected, brought that up, and it wasn't something I'd really thought about all that much. And so maybe folks listening would be interested in thinking about that some more through the lens of what you're writing about here. It occurs to me that since we've had a couple of Greek terms, I think there's a Russian term we ought to talk about a little bit, life creation, because I think that kind of tags on to what you were talking about a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about that whole idea and how it's placed in the overall scheme of Russian art here?
Yeah, I mean, and the term in Russian is used, творчество, and really using your own life as a form of creativity. And that's somewhat dangerous, and it became somewhat dangerous in the way that artists stylize their lives to construe their lives as a work of art. And you know, it's certainly tied in with decadence movement in Europe at the end of the 19th century. But with sports, it becomes all the more visible, or that these artists were not only seeing their lives as works of art, but emulating the athletes that they saw. So the creative act becomes them becoming, or at least presenting themselves on a canvas or in a book or on a film as an athlete, and infusing their art with that athleticism, you could argue in a certain way that that was a way of almost legitimizing the life creation, the жизнь творчество, because if it's just a decadent thing that artists sort of take part in, It could be perceived as pretension, but if they're, so many of these artists, and I could just go through a bunch of them, saw themselves as, or presented themselves as athletes, wanted to become athletes, and wanted to change their own self in a way that was almost revolutionary. And that's how it ties in so well with the Russian avant-garde, that they wanted their art to transform life. And if you're going to transform your life, a good way to do it is through athletics, instead of being the sort of weak or unhealthy artist. They would become these strong, healthy, vigorous, enthusiastic athletes that might, in that way, and sort of almost with that strength, transforming society. And that strength would give it to them.
I think you should talk about a few names. I'm guessing.
Okay, sure. So
give us a few examples.
All right. One of the chapters I talk about some poetry in there. So we have Alexander Blok, and Blok is, known for his symbolist poetry that is very mystical of sorts, and then. In the teens, he starts going to wrestling tournaments and starts lifting weights. And he himself was in other ways, in somewhat unhealthy ways, practicing life creation with his symbolist colleague Andre Billy and some of the things they envisioned for themselves. But in this instance, what's that?
Love triangles don't tend to turn out
correct well. With Lubov Mendeleeva, and the daughter of the father of the periodic table, Blok's wife, but in sort of life creation, thought of her as some mystical woman, and I don't think he ever even slept with her, or didn't, for many years didn't sleep with her, and then created this sort of Harlequin Commedia dell'arte love triangle that was very unsavory and probably ruined her life. Not sports related, but interesting facet of cultural history. But then he starts lifting weights and bicycling and doing all these vigorous things and seeing that as a transformative thing in his life. You see that, and sort of out of that era, out of that period comes a certain different art for him. You have Ilya Mashkov and painting a portrait of him and his colleague Konchalovsky as two painters from a very sort of decadent group of painters as bodybuilders, and all of a sudden they're presenting themselves as hulking strongmen, and it wasn't merely a joke in a painting, but actual sort of strength work that they did in their lives. So it was not just bravado or just a wink and a joke, but something that they took seriously, I think, over Mashkov for Konchalovsky's studio was that only the strong should be working here in this studio. So you have that. You have the poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, who also sort of envisioned himself at certain points as a man of the future, a man of strength. You have Lentulov is another painter. It slightly dissipates after the revolution, but so many of these artists are doing sports or practicing sports, or you get to all Russian Soviet avant-garde cinema, and the camera, the quintessential Soviet avant-garde film, Man with the Movie Camera, and the actual man with the movie camera in the film is so athletic and participating in swimming on the beach, and just the way that he is filming is seen as an athletic thing. So they're all trying to incorporate the athletics into their lives and into their art at the same time. And then even someone like Vladimir Nabokov, who grew up in the teens in St. Petersburg, it's not as though it's exactly life creation, but he definitely saw himself as an athlete, and the athletics and that play becomes a prominent part of his art.
When I started reading that section of your book, I instantly thought of the character Rachmetov from Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done in 1863.
Yes.
Is there some direct kind of literary inspiration there, that novel having been so influential?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the people coming certainly saw that novel and Rachmetov, and specifically the character of Rachmetov. He eats, he lifts logs and eats beef, and really wants to, that revolutionary transformation. It's not as though all of the writers I have in mind or write about revered Chernyshevsky, but I think that model was seen as something important as Russian society moved towards the turn of the century and towards the revolutionary these revolutionary moments of 1905 and 1917, that I certainly think that What Is to Be Done played a large role in how art functioned and was seen as perhaps precipitating some of the revolution. And that's what I find so interesting about Russian artists at this time, that there was this real messianic belief that they could transform the world through their art, or at least the country, and facilitate revolution, and that by advocating for revolution through art, that would transform society. So, and then the way that sports fits into that, I think in a somewhat maybe indirect but almost direct way of them saying, okay, we can change ourselves, we're making ourselves strong revolutionaries, that is, so if we can do it to ourselves and we can promote it in our art, that will be an indication that art can transform society, which is what they all believed would happen. In some ways there were some false hopes, I suppose, but certainly this messianic character, and I think sports really did have a role to play with that.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, even if you think back to the whole the era of the radicals of the 1860s.
Yeah.
Their overall focus is much more inward rather than they're not big, you know, they're not thinkers like Herzen, right? They're thinking about like, what kind of person should I be? You know, which sounds very much like what you're talking about here later on.
Yeah. Yeah. And even Belinsky has a few comments about gymnastics and so forth. So they're all thinking about it, and then it just sort of, it's the momentum of it certainly grows for out of Chernyshevsky, but as somewhat outdated a novel it is, but it's sort of an interesting novel in itself. But
not prosaically speaking, I hope I never read it again, but in terms of its influence,
it's another tie-in with Nabokov as well, because Chernyshevsky wrote What Is to Be Done, and then Nabokov, in his great last Russian novel, The Gift, has a whole chapter which is a biography of Chernyshevsky, a stylized biography that his protagonist writes, that is one of the chapters in The Gift. It certainly was that which indicates how prominent a cultural figure Chernyshevsky had become. Yeah. Controversial, but important. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think maybe now would be a good time to kind of lay out what changes in artistic depictions of sport from, you know, let's say before the mid 20s, this kind of very imaginative, creative era in the early Soviet era, to what changes in depiction of art from that, looking towards, you know, the era of socialist realism.
It
might be a good idea to go ahead and define socialist realism when you get that far too.
Yeah. Why, you know, and how things change. I mean, they saw their art changing society and playing a part in the revolution. The revolution happens in 1917. They still feel that their art has a role to play in the new society, which I think certainly allowed for some artistic freedom and creativity. I think there was plenty, but at the same time, politics and that connection that by its very nature, they helped bring about this new regime, sort of began to control things, I guess, more. Yep. Is how I see it. And that throughout the 20s, the artistic freedom gradually dissipates. I mean, almost right off the bat, you get certain artists eliminated, or very soon after, 1921, either dying or being repressed. other artists being able to do what they want, but it was an expectation that they would participate in the new Soviet state. And, you know, I think a figure like Trotsky, whom I mentioned in the book, certainly advocated for some artistic freedom and envisioned art playing an important role in society and in the new state, and that filmmakers, writers, painters could participate in that, but gradually the artistic freedom dissipates, which is maybe could have been predicted. And then the formalism, as it was called, the formal ideas, and the formalism became the catchphrase, where formalism being the catchphrase for anything that had creativity in it, gradually becomes a almost as dirty word throughout the 1920s, and there was less opportunity for artists to participate in a creative way, not doing what the state wanted. And one of the ways I see, again, why sports is important is that it was almost this backdoor to creativity, that sports were being advocated for by the new government. They wanted the Soviet populace to engage, be healthy, and they wanted to transform society. So sports becomes this mode of creativity for a number of artists, especially I talk about the photographers, who all of a sudden are, you know, these folks are picking up cameras and creating these very beautiful, very arresting, very formal images of athletics as one of the ways that they can be creative and one of the few ways that they can have that creativity. So through the 20s, you gradually see the freedoms dissipating, and then Stalin comes to power gradually in the 20s, and starts, it's really technically socialist realism emerges in the early 30s, but it's already part of the discourse, I would say, indirectly in the late 20s, where they must depict a reality that doesn't exist. It's almost depicting, I guess it would be a depiction of a reality that the government was hoping for or wants. And that it was expected that artists would depict that that future reality rather than exploring the present, and that was going to be expected of all Soviet artists. And then gradually the restrictions become more draconian, and artists are either killed or they conform. They conform or they're killed, and gradually art is essentially squelched. And you even see that in the works of certain artists that come at sports in a real creative way. Alexander Dineka, who also sort of in certain ways envisioned himself as an athlete, has a great self-portrait, but ultimately has to sort of toe the line in terms of state policy and sports and depicting happy athletes in Soviet society. So and you see it with all the art or artists, or they either produce or they just go silent or they're killed. Mandelstam being one who, you know, before the revolution, who wrote about poetry, and then eventually he's sent out to Siberia, where he dies.
It occurred to me as a kind of summary that it's like we're moving, you know, say pre-mid 20s from life creating art to after that to art creating life creating art. Right? Start off with this big idea.
Yeah.
And then we that creates the life that we're envisioning, and then we're doing art about that, you know?
Part of that, yeah, and it's...
It's almost like a three-stage answer to the old art and life question.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, it's such a, you know, I don't think, there is this old, you know, debate about the Boris Groys that, you know, that the seeds of socialist realism were planted in Russian avant-garde art, and that it was leading towards socialist realism in Russian avant-garde. And I don't take such a sort of black and white view of it, and feel, you know, certainly there was creativity, there was great creativity, and it's eventually squelched by the powers that be. And, I don't think it had to end the way that it did, but perhaps, as I mentioned, the wanting to be involved and be engaged in this revolution, it's hard to extract art from that process. If you think that art has a role to play in society, what do you do when there is somebody that says that the all right, our new society is going to be this way, and you have to produce art that supports it. So I find sports an interesting prism through which to, at the very least, to view socialist realism. Yeah.
So is that why then? I'm just making sure I'm kind of putting all this together. Is that why photography then becomes kind of a safe outlet, because nobody can accuse you of making stuff up because in the photograph, right? But at the same time, like, the way you take the photograph or whatever allows you some artistic freedom. So it's kind of a safe outlet for your artistic impulses.
Yeah, it is to an extent, but then even that, then, you know, then critics start critiquing the angle of photographs and the way, and the content. Yeah.
Huh. Yes. Do you have any, just maybe you do, maybe you don't, but do you have any particularly good examples of like what kind of photograph could get you in trouble? I mean, obviously you could like take a picture of the wrong thing, you know?
I'm trying to look.
Like, what would it mean to get a photograph wrong in 1931? You know, I guess that'd be a good way of putting my question. A photograph of sporting,
I'm looking here. I want to see if I can find a quotation. Because there were a lot of journals, fascinating journals, that produced these... produced these photo or included these photographs, and it was actually one of the more enjoyable parts of the research was having the opportunity to just look at some of these old journals and find these photographs. But there was a conservative critic, Leonid Mezhoritchir, who became an official for the Soviet photography organ, and he wrote about this image. It's a very formal image of a tennis player, and it appeared in Proletarian Photo. So you would think, okay, it's fine, you know, shows a guy playing tennis, but then this is the critic. Our comrades from October wonderfully wield the technical side of photography, but that October was a group of photographers. But questions of composition, texture, perspective, angle, disproportionate foreground and background, etc., have begun to play such a dominant role for them. As a result, we have a series of works from which one gets the inverse impression of that which was conceived. Smirnov's Falling Tennis People skiing up a mountain rather than skiing down it in Grunthal's park, KO, and the tea kettle that dominates Langman's young commune, Dinamo, his almost incomprehensible image radio gymnastics. All this testifies to drastic formalist deviation amid a lack of political intuition.
Off with his head.
Off with his head. Yep. Yeah. Doing, you know, going way too far here, right? For the authorities, right? And he's critiquing that. And, you know, and these artists, these photographers thought, okay, this is a great way to, you know, I found a safe space, so right. to speak, for my art. But no, not in the least.
Well, that kind of puts you over a barrel when what you can envision in your head is off limits and what you can take a picture of in real life is off limits too. That doesn't leave much left.
No, it doesn't. And then you get to these so many photographs of political, you know, sports parades.
Right. And I kind of wanted to get to that actually. So maybe you could just talk about the kind of mass sports phenomenon, like does that get depicted in art? But the other thing I wanted to ask you about too was you had that really interesting section in there where you were talking about how, like in the Stalin era, sports related art starts to really focus on individual acts and kind of heroism, right? Which in the abstract sounds backwards.
Yes, it does. Yes, exactly.
So it could be backwards. So on the one hand, maybe you could talk about mass sports events, but also, like, how is that not backwards in context of the time? What makes that make sense, given Stalin era?
Yeah, it took me a while to really, almost, as I was writing this, wrap my head around that conundrum that, you know, wanted to argue that, you know, that it's that Stalinism squelches the individual for the sake of the masses. That's what one might assume would have happened, but that's not the case at all. That it was this mass movement that the early Soviet culture promoted, that they wanted everybody to be as many people to be healthy and active as possible, that it was seen as a positive thing, and that society needed to change in that way. And thus avant-garde artists really began to delve into the mass movement of sport, especially in cinema, and the connections between the mass art of cinema and the mass activity of sports, be it spectators or participants. Stalinism, though, disregards that, I suppose you could say, promoted it in a little bit of a way, but also wanted to see elite athletes as examples of that new Stalinist state, that instead of mass participation, it became, and this, you know, it happens in a lot of places, where instead of it being about the masses, it's about the country glorifying itself, that Stalin wanted individual athletes to, as a sort of a metonymic representation of the entire Soviet Stalinist state, that Stalinism was superior. So it just less of a concern. It's not as and then you have these parades, which are in itself promoting sports, but not really athletic at all. They're just folks marching in a celebration of sports, but not, you know, they're rigid formation and not the playful. It's almost removing the play of sports from athletics. And that's, you know, there are these journalists, what is it? What's the name of the journal? USSR Today, I think, or I forget the name of the title of the journal, but it just has, it promotes sports and says it is promoting the sports movement, but it's really focusing on that elite performance.
So in a way, it kind of takes the play out and puts the competition back in.
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, there is a bit of a but
you know, like Stakhanovism, you know, in the in the book, you know, the kind of socialist competition, right?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, there is a bit. Yeah, the Stakhanovites in and almost unrealistic competition in a sense. And so it does. I mean, even Dineka's paintings show almost athletic excellence, and you know, it doesn't. That mass participation just, I think, is the key, where there could be some competition, but it's not really about it's more about getting the country involved rather than one person triumphing over another, where the Stalinist does return to that, just as we see that in Nazi Germany as well, that sure, we're going to prove our superiority through sports. And again, there is nothing wrong with competition per se,
right,
but then if it's used in a way, certainly by the Nazi Germany at the 1936 Olympics, but also Stalinist Russia or Soviet Union also has a somewhat, it's not fascist certainly, but it has a unsavory use of athletics to prove its superiority.
That point struck me because, you know, at the beginning, correct me if I get this wrong, but back at the beginning of our talk, you know, it kind of sounded like, these two, excellence and competition.
Yeah.
During the early era that we're talking about here, it seems like the competitive part of it drops out a bit and the excellence part waxes. And then later on during the Stalin era, it kind of seems like it's the reverse, at least to an extent.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. There at some point there's an equilibrium that is probably what is the healthiest.
Yeah.
The healthiest, no, I guess no pun intended, but when you can have a striving for excellence, but also competition, and cherish both of them. It's that is sort of an ideal that they, I think Europe, it's achieved in Europe and in Russia to an extent. I mean, maybe that's what Nabokov harkens back to from his own youth and sort of continues it in an immigration where he grew up in this time. He obviously grew up in a very wealthy household where he could play tennis, he could play soccer, and engage in these sports. It wasn't, I don't think he saw it particularly as, the great excellence per se. It's not exactly it, but it's, and it's not just competition, but it's a combination of both, and that sort of love of play and a striving for excellence in a certain way in his own life, and that he finds the perfect balance and continues that after into the 30s in immigration. Yeah.
We're getting about to the end of our hour here, but as you were talking there, one more thing maybe occurs to me. I don't really follow the Olympics or anything like that myself, but
yeah.
When was the So the Russian Olympics here, what was it, like 10 years ago or?
The Russian Olympics, are you talking about the Soviet one or, yeah?
The more recent one when...
In Sochi, yeah. Yes, right, yeah, right.
What I was wondering is, you know, obviously there's, you're thinking about the increase in the importance of like, of sports as symbolizing the health of your country as a kind of yeah. nationalist sort of overtone under Stalin, right?
And then cheating, yeah. And,
yeah, you followed exactly what I was, my train of thought here. So I guess I was wondering then, I don't know if this is something you've, you know, looked into or not, so it's kind of a long shot, but I mean, is there something like the Sochi Olympics, like, has that become the subject of kind of nationalist inflected art as well, you know, in more recent history or no?
Ooh.
I mean, yeah, I'm totally putting you on the spot here. I don't know
yeah.
if it occurred to me to ask as you were talking about that Stalin era issues there.
Yeah, and that it becomes, and your question would be whether it is
like sort of, say in context of the Sochi Olympics, mm-hmm. would if there's any, you know, coverage of that in art.
Yeah.
That kind of art that's produced in that era, does that kind of resemble, you know, Stalin era?
Stalin, I bet there is some. I don't, what comes to mind, and this isn't exactly art that celebrates sports, but there was this opening ceremony that they had for the Sochi Olympics, where it was going through the Russian alphabet. And at the opening, for the opening ceremony, and with each letter taking a cultural item from Russia and celebrating it in through visuals.
Yeah.
And they go at the beginning, they go through it. It's extremely propagandistic. It touches on Nabokov, Tolstoy, a lot of Russian writers. There's the Sikorsky helicopters. There's a lot of different cultural artifacts. And I used to show it to students, and we used to show it here at Bryn Mawr to first year Russian students. And then gradually it becomes, you know, dawned on me that this is so propagandistic. And, you know, nowadays I wouldn't dare show it. It's just, it reeks of sort of Putinism.
It would have to be presented carefully.
Yes. Yeah. As an artifact of Putinism that he is, you know, he is producing art, you know, artistic product that is very, very slanted and propagandistic and pro-Russian. And it was right after the Sochi Olympics that they invaded Crimea.
Right.
So it's sort of out of that Olympics comes not only the cheating scandals, but the sort of geopolitical maneuvering that has led us to today in certain respects, which is a bit scary and taints sports in a little way. And that's also part of the history, is that sports has been tainted in certain ways by its association.
You talked in the book about the problem of like rigged wrestling, you know, thrown wrestling matches and so on. So
yeah. And then, that's one thing. Yeah. But then you're doping and, part of sports is going to be trying to cheat a little bit. That's just only natural. But then, you know, once the cheating becomes so egregious, then it renders the agon and the aret irrelevant.
Yeah.
And it makes sports pointless if it's all, you know, that's what I think of professional wrestling. If it has, you know, I wouldn't waste my time with it. If it's all an act, then it's not real competition. What's the point of it per se, other than a spectacle. Yeah, and that's in the same you could say for the doping scandals at Sochi, that you know, after a while, you know, if these guys are all doping, why take an interest in it if it's going to be a bunch of whoever can cheat the most wins. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to knock off our talk, Tim. So thanks for taking an hour or so to talk to me about the book. I was really looking forward to this.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I enjoyed it.